welcome to Movie Schmovie.
What's up, guys?
Starring myself and Steven.
Who is myself?
I'm Ronald.
Oh, yeah, you might want to say that.
All right, I always forget to...
I don't want anybody thinking that I replaced you or anything.
I know, a vital piece of information. I get replaced by another charismatic black person.
Yes, with a voice like yours. Like, not going to happen.
Right. So
it's probably the most common feedback we've gotten on the podcast.
I've heard porn star.
70s porn star.
70s porn specific. Star. Evening radio personality.
Like the nightlight kind of stuff, right. Sexy music that sort of call thing. In the
which is strange because I don't think I sound like that, but that's because I'm
if you think that Ronald sounds like that, feel free to email us at movieschmovie@gmail.com.
Please.
Speaking of that,
there's several other places you can reach us. Facebook.com/movieschmovie, movieschmovie.net, which is basically our hub where we have news. We post the newest podcast there. It's pretty much like our lair where we pretty much dwell there and put our entries about movies we like, things we're interested in. It's our place.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely our base station, but we also have like the Twitter accounts, you know, iTunes, Mixcloud is the other place we host it.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, there's lots of ways to reach us, but definitely go to the movieschmovie.net. That's where we kind of post the news and everything. We try to throw up as much as we possibly can, so... I know you kind of get tired of us saying it, but, you know, it's kind of like a little indie thing that we do on our own, so it's kind of required, and we apologize for sounding like broken records, but definitely try to help promote this and tell some people to check us out.
Definitely. So this is episode 13, right?
Episode 13, man.
Episode 13.
Lucky or not lucky, I don't know.
Right. I feel like it's kind of lucky. It's a weird number, odd, but we're here.
I'm excited because it's actually a movie that I was really excited to see, and stars one of my favorite actors, and probably the only man that I'd be willing to go to the other side for.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Bradley Pitt.
Mr. Bradley Pitt.
Bradley Pitt in Moneyball, starring
himself.
Brad Pitt.
Yeah, Brad Pitt.
Jonah Hill and Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah, a lot of big names in this film.
Yeah, Bennett Miller.
Yeah, Bennett Miller.
Good movie. So, but before that, we're going to do our Mighty Minute review, which you're going to touch on because I haven't seen the movie yet. So.
Yeah, actually, I'm pretty excited about this one. We had somebody write in for this film. I think it was Jeff. And Warrior is the film. It came out a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Kind of wasn't received as well as I hoped it would have been. I'd been looking forward to this film. If you check out the blog, I threw a bunch of news pieces up on this over the past few months. Tom Hardy, Joel Edgerton, Nick Nolte, Jennifer Morrison are, you know, the key cast. It's directed by Gavin O'Connor, who did, most people would probably know from Miracle, the Kurt Russell hockey film, which is another good film. But basically, Warrior is a MMA-style Rocky film, you know, kind of like the fighter.
Mm-hmm.
Underdog going up through this big tournament, you know, for the big prize or the purse. But it's kind of got a cool spin on it, mainly because the two central characters are two brothers, and they have their different motivations. Their father is kind of like the backbone of the two. There's a lot of family history that's brought up throughout the film at a very diligent pace that's, I think, works really well for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird. I think that if this film had come out this time next year, it probably would have been a lot more successful because Tom Hardy, you know, has probably one of the biggest roles coming up next summer, filling, you know, the shoes of Bane for the new Batman sequel. I don't know how somebody will one-up Heath Ledger's role as the Joker.
Right.
But, you know, I'm sure he's going to do, you know, a justice.
I think he will, too.
But, you know, the Warriors in theaters now, anybody that's a fan of the underdog story, you know, very motivational, very emotional, a lot of really incredible choreographed fight scenes if you like MMA. I'm not into MMA, but, I mean, I was literally biting my fingers watching this movie because you don't know who's going to win. And you don't really know who you're rooting for more so than the other. And that's one of the cool things because there's really not a bad guy in this movie. So Warriors in theaters now, and I definitely recommend checking it out. So
Cool. Hopefully
you'll watch it.
I will.
Eventually. You were supposed to see it before me, but...
I know. I haven't been too diligent. Super duper sleeping on this movie.
So I think we're going to move on to Moneyball now. We're going to get right into it. Like we got some really positive feedback on our new format last week with Drive. So we're going to kind of keep this lean and mean and kind of cut a lot of the fat out.
Oh, yeah.
So like Ronald said, this week's episode's feature review is Moneyball. So here's a clip from the film. So check out Moneyball.
I need more money. We're a small market team. Fine players are the money that we do have.
There's a championship team that we could afford because everyone else undervalues them, like an island of misfit toys.
We're going to shake things up.
You don't put a team together with a computer.
Billy Bean has tried to reinvent a system that's been working for years.
I say it's just getting started.
What is happening in Oakland?
It defies everything we know about baseball.
Just plain crazy.
So, Moneyball is a story of early 2000s Oakland A's struggling, managed by Billy Beane, portrayed by Brad Pitt. So basically, this team's struggling. Billy Beane is really sick of the system that's being used currently, which is basically the good old boys of baseball kind of determining, based on looks and charisma and build, how a team can pretty much work together to be champions. Now, Billy really is in doubt of this old method of getting sort of old school players to determine who's going to be the next person to be the big star,
right.
Jason Giambi,
right.
Players of that caliber.
Sure.
And pretty much he tries to find a way to change the system, and he does.
I think one of the big frustrations he's also, you kind of introduced to right away, like the film opens up on, you know, basically the A's losing to the Yankees in the 2001,
right.
You know. I think, I don't know if it was a divisional series or the championship series for the American League, one of the two. But immediately, he knows that they're losing key players like Jason Giambi,
right.
And Johnny Damon, and Isringhausen because of payroll.
Right.
And that's really one of the big factors that the film talks about. You know, the film is based on a novel, you know, that was basically, you know, written by Michael Lewis. I think it came out in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of Moneyball really is this, like you kind of alluded to, the idea of not having to work within the good old boy system. The fact right. that the Yankees payroll is $110 million
mm-hmm.
and a team like the Oakland Athletics, you know, can barely afford a $30 million payroll.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you make your team competitive and return to a championship series the following year when you lose your three marquee players to teams that can pay them more?
Right.
You really can't. And that's kind of what we examine through the film, through, you know, a couple different systems that we're introduced to. But I mean, that is pretty much the backstory. You know,
mm-hmm.
anybody that's a fan of baseball, even if you're not, you may have heard of the story back in 02. I remember I've always been a really big baseball guy. Baseball has gone downhill the past 10 years, which is really saddening. But this is one of the last really big things you remember from baseball in the early 2000s is the Oakland Athletics, like, winning 20 games in a row.
Right.
You know, breaking a record that, you know, I think was nearly 100 years old,
mm-hmm.
That maybe never thought was going to be broken.
Right.
You know, and along with things like the home run record and Cal Ripken's Iron Man streak, it was an era that baseball was like, it was at a peak, you know, and unfortunately it's gone down, but it also marked a point in baseball where the thought process changed.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't about who can we pay the most, and you learn, you know, we kind of get introduced to that throughout this film, but I think we're going to, let's touch on a little bit about, like, the actual travel from the
right.
book to the screen. And,
absolutely.
Because it wasn't a clear road, right?
No, absolutely not. So, originally, David Frankelis, I hope I'm pronouncing that.
I think David Frankel.
Frankel?
Yeah.
It's Frankel?
Sure.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm pretty sure it's Frankel.
This name is not indicative of how it's pronounced. So, this guy apparently first was the first writer of the story. Then Steven Soderbergh kind of replaced him, along with another gentleman. And because of scheduling conflicts with The Contagion kind of being the movie that was being made by
Soderbergh's
yeah. movie, they weren't able to do it. Now, originally, the movie was supposed to have bits and pieces of footage of the real-life event. Some of the real players, like David Justice, was supposed to play himself. And it was supposed to be a different sort of tone to the movie. Now, because of the scheduling conflicts and all that stuff, Bennett Miller replaced them and Aaron Sorkin rewrote the script, which kind of changed the tone of the entire film. And you can't help but wonder if Soderbergh would have done it with the footage, how it would have been. But it was really pretty interesting.
Yeah, I was actually checking that out myself, and it's kind of weird because, like, it's what it sounds like Soderbergh was trying to do with his script that he co-wrote with another writer, and like his vision for the film as a director was like a weird mixture of like documentary
right.
style
along with some
like actual feature film footage, which is like really, I mean, I guess from a studio perspective there was probably some butting heads because it's like that's kind of hard to market a sports film
right.
Like that. I mean, this film itself is kind of hard to market as a sports film because of the content.
Right.
You know, it's not like those franchise teams, like it's not a Yankees movie or a Red Sox movie.
Right.
you know.
It's a hard sell, seriously, yeah. Even with Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. And also pretty interesting as well, Dimitri Martin was originally supposed to play Peter Brand, the gentleman that comes into Billy Bean's life that kind of changes the way he thinks about baseball.
Sure.
And has this system put in place to kind of use a budget and the system of runs rather than just who looks good, who's, right. You know, that sort of old boy, good old boy sort of system of doing right. things. Now, in general, I think that this movie was really good.
In general.
I thought that a really strong performance by Philip Seymour Hoffman, who played Art Hal, Chris Pratt, who's very famous through Parks and Recreation.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of different sort of character in this story, a little more serious. Playing the first baseman, Scott Hatterberg, who kind of is one of the main characters that kind of gets put into this new system that Peter Brand and Billy Bean are trying to implement.
Sure.
A's is kind of numbers game. Really good, strong performances from all the people.
So. Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is like the reason that Chris Pratt actually gets like almost like a, I mean, he's not the star of the film, but he's a, you know, supporting role, but he's one of the stars of the team,
because mm-hmm.
he pretty much exemplifies what Peter Brandt's idea is, and it's really not an idea that Peter Brandt like really created. It was a gentleman named Bill James who they actually talk about briefly in the film, and they show a photo of him, you know, and how he only worked at the meat factory, and
mm-hmm.
it was his kind of idea that he came up with years before. And he kind of coined the term sabermetrics is what it's based on. And it's more of an objective way of looking at empirical evidence of or empirical statistics of a player rather than, you know, the number of home runs he hits. You know, they almost place more values on he who gets on base can score and he who scores more runs wins more games.
Right.
So they have this system of evaluating how many times a person can walk, how many, you know, times they've been hit by a pitch. Once they're on base, how many bases they've stolen, how many times they've been thrown out. Things like that all become much more heavy factors in whether a player is valuable enough to say, yeah, we should offer Jason Giambi more money. Mm-hmm. Because when Peter Brand comes in and reevaluates the system, it's like, it's not bad that you lost him.
Right.
You know, it sucks for the team because you're like, oh, he's our star. But he has an idea of, like, instead of trying to replace somebody, you know, replace Jason Giambi with a person,
right.
What their goal is basically to replace him, you know, in the aggregate. That's fine. Three players
right.
with the amount of money that we were paying him, that their collective value in terms of how much they can get on base will help us score as many runs as he did.
Right.
And I mean, and at that point in time, it was ludicrous. Like,
right.
teams were not using it.
Really strange because football and basketball use these methods constantly and have been for a long time.
Yeah.
But it just kind of speaks to the culture that exists in baseball for so long, just kind of uncompromising some of the older players kind of determining what makes a good player. And what makes a good player in Billy Bean's eyes and Peter Brand's eyes is kind of this formula of a player rather than
it literally is an algorithm that he has like on an old computer. You see him like punching numbers in certain scenes in the film, and there's like a little percentage that pops up at the end,
mm-hmm.
and that's your value. It's kind of cool to see that because, like, you know, as a fan, like I said, I was aware of this whole idea of what they were doing in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was much younger then, but it was like, it didn't make sense to me as much as it makes sense now that I see it in the movie,
mm-hmm.
and in some of the more dramatic scenes. But you're right, like, baseball has some of the most deeply ingrained conventions in any kind of league of professional
right.
sport.
It's interesting.
And there's scenes in the film where Billy and Peter are kind of going, you know, head-to-head with, like, the team scouts
mm-hmm.
that they have on staff. And, like, these guys are the old-school guys, like you were talking about. They're talking about how good-looking the players are, how many home runs they hit.
Right.
You know, they're looking for the players that are the five-tool player. And in baseball, prior to that, and even to this day, I mean, those kinds of factors, like, he who hits for average, he who hits for power, you know, running, throwing, fielding, like, those are the five tools they look for. And not many players have
right.
five.
Right, right.
Some have two, and they hope to be able to develop one or two more. But, you know, and that's kind of what sabermetrics kind of focus on. It didn't matter that you had five. It mattered which combination of the five
right.
would put points on the board.
Which is smart.
Actually. Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, you know, and throughout the film, you see, like, the pushback. And then you see it slowly being adopted. And then you see it in action. And the fact, like I just said, in that season, you know, they broke a record. They won 20 games in a row. So, you know, it's something that it's weird because it's cool. It's weird because it's really interesting to see it take place on the screen and know myself knowing how this movie will end,
right,
and knowing how baseball is today, how many teams now adopt that.
Right. And it's a smart sort of plan.
And I mean, and like you just said, in professional sports, in other leagues, mm-hmm. Some variation of it has been, you know, used for some time.
Right.
The funny thing is, though, too, I read about, and you kind of see a little bit of it in the film, the guy who created sabermetrics, mm-hmm. Bill James, the year after this film takes place, the Boston Red Sox brought him on staff as a consultant,
mm-hmm.
To try to implement this idea that Billy Beane really pioneered in Major League Baseball. And he still works for the Red Sox. He has a front office position now. And he was a part of the Red Sox winning their first championship however many fucking years that was.
Yeah.
2 years or 3 years after this movie takes place. So it's kind of crazy. Like,
that is crazy.
You know, like how much ridicule this guy got. And he becomes a part of a team. And, I mean, Red Sox are right up there with the Yankees in terms of how beloved they are.
Oh, yeah,
and how protective
definitely.
Their fans are.
Right.
And it's a team that, like, wins a championship.
It's one of those things. Like, I think one of the recurring themes is kind of the kickback that they get for being the first to kind of implement
this, it's
a radical plan.
Sure.
Especially at a time where nobody's really doing it. It's cool. I mean, I read up on the script a bit, and there were some liberties that they took, which I think is, it happens with movies.
Right.
Art Howe, for example, I read an article, Scott Hatterberg was interviewed, the actual player.
Yeah.
The one that played, he was a catcher turned first baseman. And there was a big plot point where there was a big opposition from Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, Art Howe, on the position, and it wasn't necessarily as big as it was played out to be.
In the film?
Yeah, and apparently there were liberties that were taken. But I think what that does is the opposition kind of makes his success so that much bigger. And
no,
I understand
it's
that
dramatic.
It was... Yeah, it's more dramatic. And
you almost get the sense, too, in the movie that Art Howe's, like, disdain for putting him at first base, you know, is because Billy's telling him to.
Right.
You know, it's like, this is the manager of the team. You know, when is a GM, you know, ever... you know, as involved. You even hear players say to him throughout the film, like, I've never had a GM like, you know, Billy Beane.
Yeah.
You know, like, as involved with players, talking to players though the way he did. Literally, almost at times, you almost feel like he's going over Art Howe's head.
Right.
So I feel like in the movie, it almost more so comes off as not anything personal against Scott Hatterberg, but more of like a, let me flex my muscle a little bit with Billy and be like, I make the roster. I'm not putting him on.
It's an ego thing more than anything. Now, in terms of, like, the tone of the movie, I think it's a movie that has heart, and it's cool because it's not forced.
Right.
And I was telling, I was saying earlier, it kind of pulls your heartstrings, but not in a corny way, which I think is really nice. It kind of unravels organically rather than kind of creating these scenarios that are clearly meant for you to react a certain way.
Yeah, there aren't many scenes in the film that, like, feel that intentional. I mean, you do have, like, subplots, like, with him and his daughter, which is probably the big...
Right, right.
Like, that's, like, the tug, maybe, at your mm-hmm. heartstrings. But it's nothing too heavy, and I feel like that's a credit to Bennett Miller. I feel like he has a very good pulse on, like, what this movie was intending to be, and that's, like, you know, a dramatic sports film.
Right.
That really isn't like a traditional sports film, because, like, I was kind of alluding to... You know, and this isn't really giving anything away about the movie. If you just, you know, have any idea how the baseball season ends, you know, the Athletics don't win the championship that year, you know, in 2002. The big climax of this film is they're actually winning those 20 games in a row.
Right.
That's the success of this whole system. That's mm-hmm. the success of this film. And that's different than a lot of sports films.
Right.
Most sports films, you rally around that fictional story where you know that, like, big payoff's coming at the end, and you know that you're going to celebrate them winning the World Series, or you're going to know that the team in Miracle, you know, I referenced Miracle earlier, like, that they're going to win that game.
Right.
You know? It's not the case here. It's more of a film about that forward thinker.
Right.
You know, the person that was trying to change something
mm-hmm.
with what they had to change it with. And, I mean, you know, I think that's probably something that they intentionally put in there that way, you know, so that you walked away with the movie.
Definitely.
You know, especially, I mean, I don't know, I'm a big baseball fan, so, like, mm-hmm. I feel like it affected me maybe differently than maybe somebody else that's not into baseball.
Right.
But that's the cool thing, though, because I feel like even if you don't know about baseball, you can go and see this film and see the struggle, you know, see the pushback, see the success, and see the effect that it had on something that is real.
Definitely.
You know, when the film closes, there's little title cards that come up and talk about, you know, what effect it had on certain teams and yada, yada, yada. But
it's definitely one of those movies. I think what else is really cool about it is the best movies I've ever seen, especially like sports movies, is somebody that comes in, starts off in the movie one way and then comes out the other end totally different. At first, you see Billy Bean, a very distant. He didn't really want to watch the games, very detached from it. And as the movie progresses, he's a lot more involved. He's shaking hands. He's friendly. He's buddy-buddy. And he was once a cold guy that kind of forgot why the sport was amazing as it was. Yeah. And then he's reminded during the course of the movie of what makes it what it is and what drives him and why he's in love with it and why he's involved in it.
Well, you find out. I mean, it's like a biopic almost because like Billy Bean, he was as cold as he was because he got kind of screwed. He didn't get screwed, but you know, he kind of didn't pan out to be all that he could have been.
Right.
I was talking about those five tool players, and like they actually call him that in the film, and you find out like, you know, he was drafted out of high school to play for the Mets, you know, and he failed miserably. Like he wasn't meant to be a Major League Baseball player, you know, and that's kind of like, you know, you can see that sticks with him. And that's one of the things I like too about the film is that Bennett Miller does a really nice job of like piecing together. He drops in little backstory like vignettes to show you where Billy's motivations are coming from, what he's been through, how he made a decision at one point in his life for the money, and now he's trying to make a decision in another way for the game, in a way, if you think. It's done really well, I think. I also want to point out some of the acting. Like I said, I'm a huge fan of Brad Pitt's. Anything he does, I pretty much like just because he's associated with it, I'm not going to lie.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be very, very challenged to find a movie that I didn't like that he was in. Maybe if he was in it in a small role, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
But I think his marks a really big point in his career because I think it's like him crossing over into like a more of a leading man territory where his looks aren't what is leading about him.
Right, right.
Like it truly is an actor. It's a meaty role for him. And I mean, you know, I cannot believe that he's 48 years old. Like, I think...
Who or what?
Yeah,
what?
I wish you could see Ronald's face right now. Brad Pitt is 48 years old.
He's 48 years old. He's kind of... He didn't... I know what you mean.
Yeah.
He's finally... I didn't want to say this. He's finally getting into George Clooney status. Mm. In terms of... Sure, George Clooney is an incredibly handsome guy. But I don't care about that. When I see him in a movie, his acting is what drives... His role,
and I feel like that's something that you and probably even myself sometimes have trouble
detaching yourself
from who that person is.
Right.
And I think like somebody like Brad Pitt, you know, he's so charismatic, he's so good looking, like everybody loves this guy, or for most parts, those who hate him for the whole Jennifer Aniston thing, myself not included. But I think that I almost more so see it as more a step towards like a Robert Redford path than George Clooney. George Clooney, I think, is a little bit of a different... In the same area, but a little bit of a different path.
Oh, yeah. But I totally understand.
I even think that he kind of looks like Robert Redford a little bit in this film at certain scenes, like in The Natural or such. But I think Brad Pitt just, like, bites this off, you know, in one big piece and chews it up. You know,
yeah,
I think he does a really nice job. I wouldn't be surprised if he gets his first Best Actor nomination this year. Depends what comes out for the rest of the year.
Right.
But to also give credit to Jonah Hill, you know, who I think does a really nice job going with a role that's not as traditionally comic that he's done. It's almost like a neat little buddy combo, you know, like a buddy movie with him and Jonah Hill, with Brad Pitt and Jonah Hill's characters.
He still has space to be kind of silly in it, which I really enjoy too, you know.
And there are a couple scenes where you kind of get that little shine through of like, you know, the crazy Jonah Hill, like his little mannerisms or like... what he says without saying something, maybe with some of those weird facial looks that he does, you know?
Right.
But I think the interplay between them was really good. And I know you mentioned Dimitri Martin supposed to be in it. I like Dimitri Martin. But I think that, I don't know that the chemistry would have been as good. I think Jonah Hill and Brad Pitt really worked off of each other very well.
Right. I also loved Stephen Bishop, who played
David Justice.
Okay. Now, this guy has absolutely no experience prior to this in terms of large parts. He's played little pieces of characters in Friday Night Lights and Girlfriends and...
Oh, man, I love Friday Night Lights.
Right, so he was also in The Town as a character named Derek. But in general, this guy, the guy that played David Justice, kind of is one of the the newer players that come into the system, and he is opposed to kind of playing along with the idea of playing his role to make the team work.
Yeah.
Just like Brad Pitt initially is opposed to being who he needs to be to make this team work. And what that means is immersing yourself in the team dynamic in order for people to understand how you're going to implement something so radical to a otherwise traditional sort of system.
Sure.
So he comes in with David Justice, and there's a scene where Brad Pitt kind of says, you know, you have to play your role or this shit won't work.
Yeah.
And at that point, they respect each other, and that's pretty much the beginning of the change that happens in the story. And I love this guy in this movie. He was so good. Chris Pratt, I said that already, he's really good in it as well. Kind of a family man, very likable. I liked it. I liked it a lot.
So, yeah, I mean, a lot of supporting cast, like, definitely showed up and, you know, pardon the pun, came to bat. But, yeah. I mean, I just truly think it's a Brad Pitt film up and down.
Definitely.
You know, you see him learning from Jonah Hill's character and vice versa in the film. Even learning from, you know, Art Howe, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman. Like, even though it's not the best of situations, like, you can tell that something is happening. And his daughter, of course, learning from his daughter. Some really good scenes between the two of them. I just really am glad, like, I get to see him in a role that's not as traditional as he takes. Right. You know, he's cool as all hell in Ocean's 11. You know, movies that I know he's coming up in, like, World War Z, which right. I'm really excited for.
Zombie film that's going to be ridiculous.
Incredible.
Yeah.
But, you know, I hope he gets credit for it. I know he's a pretty face, and I know he's got some respect within the industry.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it definitely marks a step in the, you know, the true movie star
yeah.
that I think he is. Hopefully the movie does well, and he can, you know, the money follows that reputation. Because I think that would help the film if it was able to make some money. But up and down, you know, I think it's a well-made film. I would say at this point in the year, it's probably on my top 10 list.
Oh, yeah, personally. Definitely.
I definitely would like to see the film again. But, yeah, Moneyball, you know, it's in theaters today. Definitely check it out. Let us know what you think of it. If you do take a recommendation, you know, hit us up on the email or on the Facebook page. We'd love to hear what you think. Moving into our last kind of segment on the
oh yeah
on the
DVD
show.
Quick picks, right?
DVD quick picks, yeah.
So
go first.
I chose a movie that's not even closely related in terms of subject matter.
Not even close.
Jonah Hill is in it.
Okay.
I chose Cyrus. Which is a movie that came out in 2010. John C. Reilly, Marissa Tomei, Matt Walsh. Good movie. It's basically about a gentleman that played by John C. Reilly just getting divorced, and he meets beautiful Marissa Tomei. And the situation is amazing. They have a spark. He wants to date her, but in his way stands Cyrus, who is a 24, 25-year-old gentleman living at home with his mom.
Right.
Who he's into making electronic music, does not leave his mom's side. And John C. Reilly has to kind of conquer this kid, this man-child, to win the love of Marissa Tomei. So it's a good movie. It's awkward.
Yeah, there's a lot of awkward. I've seen it myself. There's a lot of really uncomfortable scenes in it.
Oh yeah, but that's what makes it so funny. This kind of, I don't know, the awkward thing that kind of has been existing with like movies lately, especially movies with John C. Reilly in them. I love the discomfort that he's put in, and he puts people in movies.
He makes you uncomfortable when he is made uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Oh, yeah. So, Cyrus is definitely a movie worth renting. So, I suggest.
Cool, man. Yeah, definitely check it out. I've seen it. It's good stuff. For my quick pick, I'm actually going to go with a more mainstream popcorn blockbuster of a film.
Cool.
Mission Impossible 3.
Yowza.
Really random. But not really, because you have Jonah Hill and Cyrus. And I have Philip Seymour Hoffman in Mission Impossible 3.
Right.
You mentioned really liking him in Moneyball. I actually thought he was maybe one of the weaker links in Moneyball, personally. I think because his screen time was kind of not really there. But I love Philip Seymour Hoffman. He actually was played Truman Capote in Bennett Miller's Capote film that actually got Bennett Miller Best Director nomination and won Philip Seymour Hoffman a Best Actor award.
Yeah.
I picked this film because it's one of my other favorite films that Philip Seymour Hoffman is in as a bad guy. Mm-hmm. And I think he is fucking awesome as a bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
Scenes that he's in this film, you know, one-on-one with Tom Cruise. I'm a big Tom Cruise fan. I love the Mission Impossible series, even 2, which was not that great. I'm very excited for the new one coming out later this year. But I think this really kind of revitalized the franchise. You know, I think it did take a misstep with Mission Impossible 2. J.J. Abrams jumped up on board for this film. Yeah. It was his actual first feature film as a director. Right. He had done shows before, like Alias and Felicity, other serials for TV. But this was the first film that he really did, and he went big with it.
Right.
Actually, might be one of my favorite. I think it might be my favorite Mission Impossible. I really liked the first one, but Mission Impossible 3 was so action-packed and set the series back up for, you know, it to take on another film, which we were going to see in a few months.
Right.
You know, Billy Crudup's in it. You know, Simon Pegg's in it. Maggie Q's in it. What a killer cast.
It's a good cast.
And one of the most shocking scenes I remember in film, like the first time I saw it, when Carrie Russell gets shot with that thing up her nose and her eye goes crooked. I remember seeing it in theater and literally dropping my jaw. Like, I'm pretty prepared for movies, but I don't know. That was really random.
It was good. I mean, like,
it jumped at me.
Philip Seymour Hoffman, which I love. The one thing I loved about him in that movie, he's like unrelenting. Like,
he does not give a shit.
An evil fucking person in that movie.
He has no concern for anybody that does not have anything to do with his goal.
I like him in that monotone, if you want to. If that's what you want to do.
Oh, that's good, man.
Fucking love him.
That's good. That's pretty good.
He has a great voice in general. I love Philip Seymour. I think that's why I liked him in Moneyball so much. It's that monotone, but you see in his facial expressions that he's fucking furious.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I definitely can see that. I'll agree with that, yeah.
Right.
And that's like in Mission Impossible, like when he's just talking to Ethan Hunt, you know, and they're like kind of going at it, you know, meeting of the minds. He doesn't change his tone.
He doesn't.
You know, he's cool as a cucumber, but you know he's like fucking pissed.
Yeah.
You know, he's trying to think of whatever he can do to ruin the day.
Definitely.
But yeah, Mission Impossible, obviously it's on DVD. A little different than Moneyball, but definitely worth checking out.
Cool.
But that's going to wrap up this episode number 13. You know, as always, it's going to be on iTunes, it's going to be on the Mixcloud site. If you can, subscribe to us through iTunes so you can always keep up to date when we release these guys. We try to do one every week.
Right.
We've been really on the ball with it recently. We have a couple things planned for the next few weeks, so we'll be definitely on task for the rest of the
we have a good schedule planned out. Yeah.
Be sure to share it with your friends. If you do listen to it on iTunes, I can't stress how important it is to actually write a review for it,
mm-hmm.
or to rate it like with the star system.
Right.
Really important, because when people search for movie reviews like podcasts on iTunes, things that have been rated, things that have received reviews, list higher in search results.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever you can do to help us maybe get our little baby listed a little higher.
Please.
Maybe in the top 100 even. Who knows?
That'd be nice.
I know I'm getting crazy with my ideas here, but I'm being an optimist. Yeah, right, forward thinking like Billy Bean. There you go, buddy.
Peter Brand.
He inspired me. But yeah, we're basically on every site, like Ronald said, when the show started. So, you know, you know how to reach us by this point.
Definitely.
And we always want feedback. So if you're liking the new format, have suggestions for us, maybe things we can try out new,
mm-hmm.
Feel free to email us. The most important thing is movieshmovie@gmail.com. And as always, you know, thank you so much for listening, and you've made our day.
Absolutely. Thank you.
See you guys later.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Try to get one more in there to beat me?
Yep.
See you guys later.